Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, January 23rd, 2025, and Alex Craner, our friend, is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Good to see you. Good to be with you again, Nima. Thank you for the invite.
Here is Alex. Let's get started with Donald Trump and his rhetoric toward the conflict in Ukraine. Here is what he published on his social media. On his account, it says that I'm going to do Russia, whose economy is failing, and President Putin a big favor. Settle now and stop this ridiculous war. It's not only going to get worse if we don't make a deal, and soon I have no other choice but put high level of taxes, tariffs, and sanctions on anything being sold by Russia to the United States and various other participating countries. Let's get this war, which never would have started if I were president, over with. We can do it the easy way or the hard way. Here comes Donald Trump coming out, the same sort of Donald Trump that we have been witnessing in his first term, just bragging about how tough he is. What's your understanding of what Donald Trump wants to do with Ukraine? It doesn't seem that he's going to accept the terms that Russia is going to put on the table.
It's very hard to me to fathom what Donald Trump was thinking with this statement. To begin with, he's all over the place. On the basis of the experience of his first 4 years in office, I'd reserve my judgment, because the first inclination is to think like, he's stupid. What is he talking about? But we've seen that very often he'll say something that's blatantly wrong or inappropriate or misguided, and then it turns out that maybe he had a reason for saying it that way. What jumps out at me there is that Russia sacrificed 60 million during World War II. It's not 60, it's 16, 1-6. So the Soviet Union as a whole lost 27 million people, Russia 16 million of those. A massive number, but not quite 60. So was it a typo? I don't know. But that's the first mistake that comes out. The second
one... A lot of typos, by the way. But
yes, ahead. Yes, exactly. Which I think, why? What is the point of all this? Then he's talking about sanctions and tariffs. Russia has already been hit with the greatest salvo of sanctions ever imposed on any country in the world, I think pretty much in history. And Russia is still there. Its economy is still doing there. They have a manageable inflation problem, but the economy is growing. The country is going more and more prosperous. It's not isolated. It's not lacking in anything. It's outproducing the whole of the Western alliance in weapons and ammunitions. And it's self-sufficient in everything that it needs. So I don't understand what Trump thinks he can do to hurt Russia at this point. This war has been going on for 3 years. And then if he's asking them to stop this ridiculous war, what does that mean? To stop it where? At what point? Just dead where it is now? Well, it can be to avoid economic pain. It would have to be in exchange for reassurances that we will make sure that Ukraine never joins NATO. We will, but he never mentions any of that. He completely fails to address any of the security concerns that forced Russia into this war in the first place. So it's almost a completely inappropriate message, which makes me think that it was, the message was aimed not at Russia, but at the domestic politics, at the domestic audience, and not his voters necessarily, but somebody else, some other segment of the American political establishment. So that's how I read this message. Otherwise, it's completely not serious. It's just Donald Trump making himself look bad in front of Russia, in front of the world, and in front of everybody who's paid attention to this in the beginning. And I'm not inclined to think that Donald Trump is stupid and that the people advising him are stupid. It tends to prove that they actually are very well informed, that they're very aware of the situation. And so I would reserve judgment at this point, or at least I wouldn't mock Trump about this statement before I understand better what the ultimate intent is. But my inclination is the message is intended at some segment of the American political establishment.
And here is a video in which Donald Trump is talking about sanctions and the relationship between Putin and Biden.
Putin doesn't come to the table to negotiate with you, will you put additional sanctions on Russia?
Sounds likely.
And yeah. Do you think that the war should be frozen currently along
the war should have never started. If you had a competent president, which you didn't, the war wouldn't have happened. Never. By the way, Russia never would have gone into Ukraine. I had a very strong understanding with Putin that it would have never, ever happened. He disrespected Biden. Very simple. He disrespects people. He's smart. He understands. He disrespected Biden.
Keep sending weapons to Ukraine, or are you going to send...
Yes, you see, it's very clear to me that Donald Trump is dodging the issues. So one thing that he doesn't mention here is that it's not that Putin didn't go after Ukraine because he respected Trump and he didn't respect Biden. It's because Trump told Volodymyr Zelensky in no uncertain terms that he expects Ukraine to abide by the Minsk agreements. Trump pressured Zelensky to respect the Minsk agreements. And I don't know if you'll remember, but when Zelensky came to visit with Trump, he was very pale-faced. He didn't get what he expected. He was very upset. And that's very visible. That was very visible in the body language between the two of them. And then Zelensky's policies turned around almost from the day Joe Biden walked into the Oval Office. On day 12 of Biden's term, he called Volodymyr Zelensky. The very next day, Zelensky banned the largest political party, largest political opposition, the party of Viktor Medvedchuk, and he took three main opposition channels off the air in Ukraine straight away. And the neocons around Biden were jubilant. You know, they were saying how, oh, they didn't really expect it, but it turned out that Zelensky was a doer. He got things done, and they were joking how the taking off this TV station off the air was Zelensky's inauguration gift to Biden. And then 2 weeks later, Zelensky actually arrested Viktor Medvedchuk. And Medvedchuk was an oligarch in Ukraine, one of the most wealthiest men in Ukraine. And he had, they expropriated, they took all of his properties away from him, which included a pharmaceutical company, which, you know, this is back in the day when, you know, the COVID vaccines were all the rage, and the Russians came out with, they were first out with a COVID vaccine, and they offered that COVID vaccine to any country that wanted it, and also offered licenses. So if some country wanted to produce the vaccine locally, they could do so. And so one of Viktor Medvedchuk's company was a pharmaceutical company that obtained a license from Russia to produce a Sputnik V vaccine. And so after Medvedchuk was arrested, they took away his companies, including this pharmaceutical companies, and then they tore up the agreement to distribute Sputnik V vaccine in Ukraine, and made Ukraine the monopoly of Western pharmaceutical companies. So going back to Trump, it wasn't the fact that he had such respect and fear for Trump that he didn't dare invade Ukraine. Trump is telling the truth in that he had a firm agreement with Putin. But that firm agreement, the relevant aspect of that agreement is that Trump was pressuring Ukraine's government to implement the Minsk agreement. Biden told them, never mind, we're going to war. And the escalation to war started straight away when Biden got into the White House. That's the difference. But for some reason, Trump is not saying this. And I think that the reasons why he's not saying is are the reasons of internal US politics. And so for people who are paying attention to this, Trump's statements almost come out incoherent, because there's the most relevant aspect of those statements is his omitting them. So it sounds very strange, but I would say let's wait and find out. I don't think they're stupid. I don't think this is a bluster. I think this is just a pose for domestic audiences.
Alex, when he says that Putin disrespected Biden, in what sense is he talking about? Because I haven't seen any sort of direct, I don't know, talks or maybe distance talk between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, in which Vladimir Putin was disrespectful of Joe Biden and what he's talking about. At least we know that Joe Biden was promising something to Vladimir Putin, and later on his administration said, oh, Biden was wrong, and we are not going to abide by what Biden was promising to Putin. But we haven't heard any sort of promise from Putin and his administration to the United States in which they couldn't keep on their promise. How can we understand that? He's just supporting Joe Biden blatantly.
It's between the lines. You know, Russian government officials, with the possible exception of Dmitry Medvedev, are polite and diplomatic to a fault. So of course they never overtly disrespected Biden or, you know, call him names or, you know, anything like that. But I think it's not wrong to say that they didn't have respect for Biden, because, you know, Biden for a very, very long time has proven himself a liar, a cheat, a thug, and practically a diametric opposite of a respectable statesman. Biden, while, let's say, when the events of 2014 were happening, the coup in Ukraine, you know, Biden is the one who persuaded Viktor Yanukovych after he signed on the, I think it was 20th, or 21st February, Viktor Yanukovych signed an agreement with the opposition, agreeing to absolutely everything that they demanded. He agreed to all of their demands. He agreed to share power with them. He agreed to early elections. Everything they asked for, he agreed. He signed the agreement. And then on the very same day, Joe Biden persuaded him to withdraw his security forces from Kiev. And, you know, Yanukovych thinking that he has the, you know, the guarantees because there were European representatives present in those negotiations in Kiev, and they were there was Steinmeier of Germany and the Radek Sikorski of Poland, and there was a foreign minister of France. They were all guarantors of their of that agreement. And then, so Yanukovych thought, okay, well, you know, that's done. They're gonna stand down. I gave them everything they wanted, and so he said, okay, I'll pull away the security forces. And Vladimir Putin was actually telling him, no, don't do that. That's very dangerous. You know, they're gonna take advantage of you. He pulled them out, and then within something like 12 hours, the opposition reneged on that agreement. They stormed the parliament, the president's the office and his private residence, and they staged a coup. They tore up the agreement and took over the government. And then the Russians had to kind of fly Yanukovych out of the country to save his very life. Otherwise, he was going to end up like Gaddafi in Libya. And so that was Biden. You know, Biden had his hand in that the whole time, and he has practically been the regent of Ukraine since 2014. So, you know, the Russians know who Joe Biden is very, very well, and he ran that place like a mafia don. And so Trump is wrong to say that Putin doesn't respect Biden, but you're right in saying that they didn't overtly show that disrespect, because he is also bearer of the office of the President of the United States. So you have to treat that with a certain respect, because in disrespecting the President of the United States, you're disrespecting the nation and its people. And so this is, you know, in the realm of diplomacy where you have to conduct yourself in a certain way, but Trump is actually correct in what he's saying.
As you've mentioned, Medvedev is an exception in the administration in Russia, but all of officials in Russia together with Putin, they're not accustomed with name calling other countries, other leaders, and they don't see any sort of outcome for that, because they're so objective, they're so determined in their way of talk, and they want the outcome. What's important for them is the outcome, is not just the way you're talking about. That's why I don't see the way that Joe Biden was calling Putin. If you remember, in his first day of when he took office, he tried to call, it was in a interview with CNN, if I'm not mistaken, he was name-calling Putin. How you calling a leader of a great power and call him a child killer, whatever it's in your mind, and you want to talk with him? And after all, it was Putin who was willing to talk with the United States. They were insisting on negotiations all along. It was the United States denying all of that.
Yes, correct. But you know, the Western Empire is very, very deeply attached to its narratives. It's actually the narrative is the foundation. And so, you know, the demonization of Vladimir Putin goes back to at least 2003. You know, in October 2003, he put one of Russia's oligarchs in prison, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, And, you know, all these Russian oligarchs, the seven bankers who were running Russia at that time, they were all trustees for the Western financial interests there. They were all working on behalf of Western financiers. And so slamming Mikhail Khodorkovsky into prison was Vladimir Putin making it very clear that he intends to reassert Russia's sovereignty, and that, you know, politics is in the hands of elected leaders, not in the hands of business oligarchs. And so the demonization of Vladimir Putin has been going on ever since, but heavy-handed. You know, he's been called a killer and a thug and a dictator and all kinds of names practically for the past 20 years. And, you know, Joe Biden has been part of this for forever, pretty much. And so this is nothing unusual. And then, you know, the Western Empire has used these types of narratives to eliminate leaders. You know, so we had madman Gaddafi, and we had the madman Saddam Hussein, and we had the madman Slobodan Milosevic. And, you know, there's always a campaign of demonization of a leader before the coup or color revolution or invasion or whatever the West is planning to do. So they're not worried about democracy because they're not looking to establish constructive reciprocal relations with other powers. They want to subjugate them. And to subjugate them, they have to remove any leader who wants to be independent, who wants to assert his nation's sovereignty and integrity. And so Vladimir Putin was one of these people. And, you know, the list is very, very long, which includes Castro and Maduro and, you know, anybody who doesn't subordinate themselves and their country to the Western diktat. And so, you know, same thing for Vladimir Putin. And, you know, Xi Jinping, he was not a KGB or a security, how do you call it? He wasn't a spy, but you always hear CCP, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, and it's always the Chinese communist. Xi Jinping is a communist. So there's always, you know, the demonization of foreign leaders is simply an integral part of the Western political culture.
Yeah. We had Iranian, Russian, we had a new agreement, comprehensive agreement, as we talked about it before, on January 17th between Iran and Russia. When you look at this agreement, and how did you find the articles in this agreement? How important is that? And what does it mean for Russia and Iran?
I think that it means something very close to an alliance. And it clearly, the security is clearly pivotal in that sense. And I think that it reaffirms something that you and I have talked about a few weeks ago in relation to Syria, to the new situation in Syria, because, you know, the events as they unfolded in December last year, they didn't really make sense to me, or at least the narratives that were being spun about it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And I believe that there must have been an agreement, and that agreement must have been primarily an agreement between Iran and Russia, and that their larger strategic goal was to pacify the Eurasian continent and to draw the Western Empire, which has been the source of instability on the Eurasian continent, to draw them into a quagmire, into a trap, which might become, you know, the cemetery, the Western Empire's cemetery, the graveyard of the Western Empire. And so, what we had over the last century or two in the Middle Eastern region was basically an architecture of divide and rule. So it wasn't a security architecture, it was an insecurity architecture, and the region has been in a long succession of needless wars, artificial boundaries, division, sectarian divisions, and then the West could easily use terrorist groups, separatist movements, and color revolutions to manipulate the region. And then they also created Israel there in the middle of Palestine, not as we were sold the narrative of a homeland for the long-suffering Jewish people, but as a beachhead where the empire could intervene and destabilize the region. And that is clear from the intent that we know about, which led to the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And the intent was overtly to, by the Round Table Group, by the so-called Milner's Kindergarten in London, the overt intent was to, quote unquote, seed the region with a particularly patriotic stocks. And I believe that this is the real reason why Israel was created. And I know that my opinion was shared by people like Hassan Nasrallah. The leadership in Iran thinks so. I think a lot of people in the West are beginning to realize that this is the case. You've had many times on your program Colonel Wilkerson, who has also realized that this is the case. And so the new security arrangement that is in the strategic interest not only of Russia but also of Iran and China, who are working and committed to this Belt and Road Initiative and the multipolar integrations on the Eurasian continent, they want to pacify the region. So the empire's beachheads have got to go. And for that reason, I believe that Israel in its current form has no future. I think that we will end up having a one-state solution there. How and when that will happen, I don't know. But clearly, Iran has been designated as the guarantor of security in the Middle East. And maybe it will share that role with Turkey. And so I think that this is why the strategic partnership between Russia and Iran is all-encompassing, economic, trade, with the north and south corridor, international and north-south transportation corridor, and also security and military cooperation. And, that is also a clear signal to people like the United States, NATO, Great Britain, that this arrangement is not transactional. This is a strategic arrangement, and they cannot undo it by, exerting pressure here and there, promising Russia to lifting of economic sanctions if you let us regime change Iran or something of the sort. I think in that respect it's a very, very important agreement, and it's been deliberately, I think, timed to be signed just before Donald Trump's inauguration, and I think that this was symbolic but also an important message to the West.
What separates Iran and Russia from Turkey or Turkey in that region is the support that Turkey is providing to these Wahhabis and these people who came in power in Syria, Daesh and Al-Qaeda, all of these groups that are extremists. And here comes the question. And I talk with Paul Carrick-Roberts. He believes that in a long run, Iran is much more important for Russia than even Ukraine, which is a huge sort of idea to put it out. But after all, if we consider what does he mean by saying that, he says that these the future, the real threat to Russia would be the extremists, would be this Wahhabism in Russia. By they want to break down Russia, and that's one of the main goals of the West in Russia, which is the common enemy of Russia and Iran together. How do you see that working in the foreign policy of these two countries?
I think that this is absolutely correct, and it's not just that I think it. This is how, you know, the West imposed the war on Russia in Afghanistan and then in Chechnya and Dagestan. They simply manipulated these Wahhabist jihadi groups and used them to wage war on Russia. And they also used them to wage a campaign of terrorism against Russia. And they will certainly, to the extent that these groups exist, that they're strong, that they're funded and armed and organized, they will continue to do that because the West will never, never, well, at least part of the West, Western powers, they will not let go of the obsession to destroy Russia. So, you know, when they run out of the last Ukrainian and if they cannot immediately mobilize, you know, the Romanians and Bulgarians and Poles and the Baltic states, then they will start using the jihadis along that are now under control of Turkey, and they have been kind of incubated by the Turks in Idlib. But you know, I expect that there are I expect that there are certain agreements that we don't know about, that are not being discussed in the open. But for sure, you know, the initial signals after the fall of Damascus, after the fall of Assad regime in Damascus, the initial signals were the Russians were kind of saying like, okay, well, I guess these head choppers really are kind of moderate, so maybe, you know, maybe it's okay, maybe we can do business with them. I thought that 100% that was a head fake, because there's no way that the Russians will be relaxed about these groups, because they, you know, they know how vulnerable they are in the Caucasus region, Dagestan, Chechnya, and thereabouts, because there have been statements out of NATO and out of the Western powers that they intend after the Middle East to move the center of activity to the Caucasus, again, always to with the view of attacking Russia. And back in the 1990s, they had a base in Azerbaijan, in Baku. And, you know, the Russian relations with Azerbaijan are touch and go. Now they're okay, but, you know, there were times when Azerbaijan was regime changed in the early 90s, and they, you know, Azerbaijan got its Zelensky, and they were, you know, Baku became a legit logistics hub for jihadis trained and recruited from Afghanistan and then sent to Dagestan and Chechnya by the CIA, by I think it was Richard Secord, the CIA's veteran of dirty trick.
Alex, can you hear me? We've lost you, Alex. Alex? Yeah. He's going to be back in a minute, for sure. Let me see if we can see some. Yeah. I'm trying to talk with Alex to see if he's going to be able to join us. He's going to be back just in a minute. Yeah, he's back.
I'm very sorry. I must have said a key word that triggered my computer. Just went into the blue screen of death in a all at once, and now is doing re-updating the Windows system and everything. So, is this okay?
Yeah, can it's you, okay.
You hear me okay? All right, okay, we can. We can continue like this, I guess.
Yeah, we can continue. And you were just, let me, okay. Alex, let's go ahead. Do you want to continue on the last question, or we can?
Wait, remind me. I know I was talking about the CIA and Richard Secord in Baku.
You were talking about the way that they were trying to manipulate the situation.
Oh yes, in right. Yes. So for all those reasons, I'm certain that there is no way that the Russians will simply allow these jihadis to regroup around the Middle East, to form their own governments and create their caliphates, and because it's a ticking time bomb for them, and they're clearly under control of Western powers. So the agreements that I referred to that I suspect might exist between Iran and Russia and Turkey and also China is that maybe the Turks will ultimately end up sacrificing these jihadis, because I think that Turkey's future lies with the Eurasian continent, with Russia, with China, with Iran, with the Belt and Road Initiative, both in terms of security and in terms of economics. The Turkish relations with the West has been very difficult. They did try to regime change Turkey. They tried to do the same with Erdogan as they did with Gaddafi in Libya. It was the Russians who rescued Erdogan from the coup in 2016, and then, you know, playing games with these proxy jihadi forces that the West uses to destabilize now Syria, next Russia, or whoever they choose, they might one day turn it against Turkey. So, you know, these are the kinds of arrangements that end up boomeranging. And I would be very surprised if the Turks weren't aware of this. Not only that, I think that now it is very clear that the Western Empire has been strategically defeated in the Middle East and in Ukraine. So, you know, to make a big alliance with the West now at this point and to agree to conduct foreign policy through these very dangerous, very unreliable, and very unstable jihadi forces seems very unlikely to me. What's the benefit? And, you know, another thing that has changed in the last few years since 2022 is that the West has made it crystal clear to everybody that whatever deal you think you have with the Western powers, whatever money you think you have in Western central banks like the Federal Reserve, it can be all taken away from you from one day to the next. And again, you know, it would be hard to imagine that the Turks haven't seen it, that they didn't take it on board and take it into consideration, and that they have discussed this with the Russians and with the Iranians, and that they decided to A, let the West have their quagmire in Syria, let them in, that the jihadi groups would be sacrificed and ultimately neutralized, and that the new security architecture in the Middle East will be arranged in probably two major spheres of influence, one controlled by the Iranians and one controlled by the Turks.
Alex, here is what Donald Trump said in terms of if we assume that he wants to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine, hear what he said about the EU, which is important in my opinion.
Ukraine, or are you going to turn off the tap soon?
Well, we're looking at that. We're talking to Zelensky. We're going to be talking with President Putin very soon. And we'll see how it all happens. We're going to look at it very soon. One thing I do feel, the European Union should be paying a lot more than they're paying, because under Biden, I mean, we're in there for $200 billion more. Now, it affects them more than it affects us. We have an ocean in between, right? Little thing called an ocean. The European Union should equalize. We're in there for $200 billion more than the European Union. I mean, what are we, stupid? I guess the answer is yes, because they must think so. But the European Union takes advantage of us tremendously on trade, and they now take advantage of, and always have. If I didn't get involved years ago, my first term, one of the first things I noticed was that they're not paying enough. They're not paying. And a lot of those countries weren't even paying, the NATO countries, they weren't paying. Only 7 out of 28 were paying. We were one of them. And Poland was one, and they had a few of them that were paying, and some were paying very proudly. Usually the closer to the borderline of Russia they were, the faster they paid, okay? The ones that were further away tended not to pay so fast. And one thing on that, I think they should lift their number not to 2%, but to 5%. NATO should be at 5%, not at 2%. 2% is ridiculous, yeah.
US President Xi.
Yeah. Alex, what does he want to do with Europe and European countries in your opinion?
I think he wants to splinter NATO. 5%, there's no way on earth that any government is now in position to pay 5% of their GDP to NATO for their security. Even 2% was very controversial back in Donald Trump's first term. That was, people were complaining bitterly about that 2%. It was too much. Many countries were saying, no, we cannot. We just cannot possibly do that. Okay, now, you know, they hyped up Russia threat and the war in Ukraine. And so they kind of, I think, got everybody to agree to 2%. And so now that's, you know, that's okay. Now Donald Trump is saying 150% more. It's not happening. So I think, to my mind, again, the question is Donald Trump stupid, or is there a different agenda? And to my mind, there's no chance that he's stupid. I think that the agenda is to break up NATO, to end it, to withdraw, because, you know, the countries will say, no, we can't pay 5%. And then if the country comes under threat for some reason, I don't know, you know, maybe in the near future there might be, you know, the Russians might launch a missile attack on the anti-ballistic installations in Romania and Poland. And then, you know, they're going to want to trigger Article 5, and Trump is going to say, well, you know, you didn't pay up, so no, you're on your own. That's that. I don't know, you know, I'm guessing, but I think it's very, very unrealistic that European countries are now going to say, like, okay, 5% of our GDP now goes to NATO. We're done with it. We're good. That, you know, even if prime ministers, presidents around somehow you twisted their arm to agree to that, it would cause a political firestorm that maybe would end those governments. So I think that Donald Trump's intent is to disentangle United States from this alliance, because it's of no benefit to the United States at this point, and it's only a risk to get them involved in another world war. Because, you know, let's face it, at this time, if somebody pulled a successful false flag attack, let's say they detonated a dirty bomb in some European cities or a nuclear device, if they were successful with that, that could draw the United States into yet another world war on the old continent. And I think that Trump and the MAGA people around him, they don't want that. They are, you know, they're not interested in fighting Europe's war. They're not interested in being in that position again, and I think that maybe 5% is a stick of dynamite thrown into the NATO organization.
In your opinion, would these parties in Europe, these rising parties like AfD, Alternative for Germany, welcome the decision on the part of the Trump administration by increasing from 2% to 5%? That could give them some sort of idea that NATO doesn't work for us. We cannot go along with that sort of plan. Let's get out of NATO.
I think that's quite possible. I think that for parties like AfD, it would be a welcome push into the direction of sovereignty, you know, developing the German military again as a German military. Same for France, same for other countries. So I think that to the extent that these parties are, you know, quote unquote right wing, but they're really sovereigntist, I think that they will welcome this.
Yeah. Here is Alex, here is what Donald Trump said about Gaza and the ceasefire. And what was so strange that in his inauguration speech, he didn't mention that much the situation between Israel and Palestine. He didn't brag about, I was the victor of the deal. I was doing this behind the scene and I brought these hostages back to Israel. He didn't do that way. And here is what he said about Gaza.
Then that you can keep the ceasefire in Gaza and conclude the three phases of this deal.
I'm not confident. That's not our war, it's their war, but
apologize.
I'm not confident, but I think they're very weakened on the other side.
Do you support the two-state
Gaza, boy, I looked at a picture of Gaza. Gaza is like a massive demolition site. That place is, it's really got to be rebuilt in a different way.
Do you plan to help rebuilding Gaza?
I might. You know, Gaza's interesting. It's a phenomenal location. On the sea, best weather. You know, everything's good. It's...
Yeah. The main point of what he's talking about is that that is not our war. It's their war. And the second point he's not talking about, he says that Gaza was devastated, was destroyed, and Gaza can be a beautiful place. And he's talking, it seems that his son-in-law is giving them some sort of clue that he's going to build up Gaza for, I don't know, for settlers. How, what's your interpretation of what he has said?
Again, you know, we have to try to read between the lines. One thing in which Donald Trump seems to be consistent, to my mind, is his inclination to disentangle the United States from all these imperial outposts, you know, from their military and security entanglements around the world. And that possibly includes Israel. And so when he says that's not our war, that's their war, I think that's a very indicative statement of his mindset. But then, you know, he's also an opportunist. He sees a good piece of real estate that is completely destroyed. And he's thinking, well, you know, maybe, who knows, opportunities in the future, you know, for a Trump resort there or something. I don't know. But, you know, it's going to be hard because the United States has also looked at the Lebanon perhaps as a plan B in the region because, you know, by this time, I think it's very, very clear to the ruling establishment in the United States that Israel as it is today doesn't have a future. And I'll remind your viewers that in 2012, Henry Kissinger himself said explicitly that 10 years from now, Israel is not going to exist anymore. So they knew that it was at the end of its rope and things have only gotten worse since then. So, okay, Israel survived through 2022, the 10-year mark from Kissinger's statement. But it's not stronger. It's not more stable. It doesn't have a better future than it did back then. So now look, the United States is building this massive embassy in Lebanon, which looks more like a Roman imperial outpost than an embassy. So getting that disentanglement is obviously not going to be easy. Somebody's behind it. Somebody's making those decisions. And East Mediterraneans, for the last 5,000 years, East Mediterranean has been extremely important to all these imperial powers because it is the place where the North and South and the East and West meet. And it's always been the beating heart of the trade between East and West. This is why, you know, the Roman Empire had their Zelensky there, King Herod, who was also up to his eyeballs in debt to the Roman moneylenders. And Cicero himself wrote that if the Roman Empire lost the revenues from this region, and he wasn't just talking about Gaza Strip or Palestine, he was talking about the whole region from Asia Minor down to Egypt, that the Roman Empire itself would collapse. So, you know, to get the United States to completely ignore that whole part of the world and disentangle itself is probably politically very, very difficult for Donald Trump. So again, you know, maybe he needs to be sending out these mixed messages where he says, like, well, is there war? But hey, look at Gaza. That's a nice piece of real estate. And maybe we should stay, maybe we should stay involved. Maybe we should come and be an investor, help with the rebuilding and things like that. But again, you know, as everything else with Trump, I think that what you read between the lines might be more relevant than the things he's saying explicitly.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. You were muted.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Always a pleasure, Nima. Thank you for the invite, and I look forward to the next time.
See you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.